welcome back to another episode of It's Funny Because It's True, the podcast starring myself, Tim Clyde, and
Alex McQueen,
with some splendid guests as we try to work out what it is that makes stuff funny. We're talking to directors, editors,
producers,
performers, stand-ups, comedians, writers, everything to try and understand the nuts and bolts, DNA of something funny. Today we've got a fantastic guest, and we're going to be investigating the art of direction. And one of the finest directors on this planet in the field of comedy is the wonderful Christopher Addison.
What a treat to have you.
Gosh.
But also, how the blazes do we know each other? That's the first question I think we should ask.
I think we first met 20 years ago.
Oh, hell's bells.
Yeah, I'm really? Sorry to have to say that. I do think it's 20 years ago because I think this is 2025 now as we speak. And I think we first met in, I'm going to say, summer 2005.
Yeah, I think it was 2005.
In a disused brewery office. On the West Way, or not on the West Way, but out in towards Acton in London. That's no longer there. It's been knocked down.
It was the Diageo premises.
The Diageo premises.
Yeah,
which have now been all rebuilt. But we were there to do the second three episodes of that first flush of The Thick of It.
That's right, because you'd been in the first three episodes.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at home feeling extremely disappointed and jealous. Because I'd auditioned for The Thick of It.
Oh, had you?
Yeah, and I hadn't got it. I hadn't got in. I looked and saw it go out. And I thought, oh, dash it. I'd love to have been in that. And then 6 months later, I get a call saying, oh, yes, you're in the next series. Because Amanda just hadn't quite formulated his. Because how many episodes was the first?
Well, so the first flush of them were three episodes.
That's it.
We recorded three episodes in January 2005, which I think that then had to wait until after the election of that year before they went out. And there were three episodes because Armando had got the money for a pilot and basically said, I can't show you what I mean with a pilot, because it was quite a new way of making a show
right
at that point. I can't show you everything. So he sort of begged and borrowed and stole and stretched the money as far as he possibly could and managed to create three episodes with his one episode's worth of money.
Oh, right.
Thus condemning us for the rest of the lifetime of that show to unbelievably cheap budgets.
Yes.
That was the ultimate consequence of that. But they went out and they did well. And so another three were needed for the kind of standard six for British sitcom run.
And how did you get into it? Were you auditioned? Did you have a coffee with Armando somewhere? How did it work?
Well, I think so. I met Armando. I did an edition of Radio 4's news quiz in 2004, the summer 2004. And at that point, he was just thinking about it. He was just thinking about putting it together. And it happened to be, in those days, the very last episode of a series of news quiz would be done somewhere away. So we were all in Portsmouth. It was me. I'd never done it before. Me, him, Linda Smith, Alan Corran, and the newsreader Brian Perkins. And I was very starstruck by all of these people. And we went
Brian Perkins.
Yeah, I know, right?
Word.
And we went out for dinner afterwards, and Armando was talking about this show that he thought there was a version of a modern version of Yes Minister to be done. And he said, you should come in and talk about it. Come and talk to me about it. And then nothing happened for several months. And I got this sort of call in the October saying, do you want to come in for a casting? And I'd been for a few castings at that point. And I wasn't really, I'm not a trained actor. I'd never reacted.
We'll come back to that.
Yes.
When you say you went in to see him.
So I went in to see the producer, Adam Tandy, in this extraordinary, weird office. It was like, it must have been a casting office, but it was full of, it was like a tiki lounge. It had a sort of bamboo bar and fake palm trees. It was so odd. And castings are awful, and I'd always hated them. I didn't know how to do them, you know. And but this one, there was no script. It was just sort of, I had to sit there with Adam, and he said, so the idea is you are a minister's aide. You're the minister for Secretary of State for Northern Ireland's aide. He's off having an affair somewhere, and the government want to get hold of him. You have to put them off. Okay, here we go. And it was enormously good fun. And then they had nothing about it for several weeks until just before Christmas, where they went, yeah, you're in, pal.
Adam play a part opposite you then?
Yeah. He was kind of the Mandarin, my boss, kind of wanting me to dob in my minister. So, So it was like most of the thick of it. It was unlike any other version of putting a program together that I've encountered.
Can you remember the first thing that ever made you laugh?
Oh, my word.
Does that sit as a sort of seared experience? Or
the first thing that ever made me laugh. I can't remember the first thing that ever made me laugh, but I can remember the first sort of significant moment where a part of my brain suddenly expanded and I realised, oh, there's this whole world of funny things over here, which is when I was about 11 or 12, in the first year at big school, my friend Andrew lent me his dad's Goon Show LPs. I'd never heard the Goons up to this point. And I think the first episode I put on was an episode called Six Charlies in Search of an Author. And I remember thinking, what is this? I was almost not laughing because I was so kind of, my mind was so blown by all of these incredible possibilities. And I can remember finishing listening to the episode, looking at the clock in my room going, oh, it's time for a low, a low.
Oh.
And going downstairs and, you know, Hello, Hello, which I'd watched and enjoyed. And I sat, I remember sitting in front of it going, what's this? Like suddenly my brain had been completely changed. And I was going, well, this is nothing. When I was looking at this kind of quite sort of broad thing that I had previously, up to a moment ago, really enjoyed.
Thought was the best.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then, but that moment, that moment of, oh, this is a whole other world, which was sort of repeated when I saw Python a few years later. It was repeated when I saw Billy Connolly do an audience with in 1985. It is the greatest stand-up tape of all time. And they fully changed my brain, those experiences.
That's great.
Completely.
What was it you think? So what was it in the craft that you were excited about that for example Hello Hello just didn't have? Because obviously that was funny. There were jokes, there were scripts, and there were funny characters.
I think Hello Hello observes certain rhythms, right? So it has so nothing in Hello Hello is surprising.
Right.
And it relies to an extent on the fact that we're expecting certain things to happen. So it's a very catchphrase-based comedy. Right, what we're looking for is for Michelle to come in and say, listen very carefully, yes, she says this only once. We want to hear about the Fallen Madonna with the big boobies. We want an Englishman who can't speak French properly. Yeah. You know, like, so all of the jokes are in place. And the thing about comedy is it's really, when it works best, it's about surprise. Right? It's about surprising ourselves or surprising our audience. And I wasn't expecting anything that happened in the Goons. So when, and it must be said that the audience who were listening, the audience who are on that record, they were expecting some of those things, because they were expecting some of those characters in the Goon shows that they knew, Blue Bottle and Henry and Min and, you know, everybody else, Moriarty, whatever. They were expecting those people to turn up and do their things, right? But I hadn't heard any of that at that point. And so it was just like, it was like looking into this kaleidoscope. Every turn, there were just these little explosions of colour, these incredible surprises, these things that I hadn't conceived of. That, I think, is what... And it... There are left turns in The Goon Show that you won't get in something like Hello, Hello, or It Ain't Half Hot Mum, or Heidi High, or, you know, the big sitcoms of the time when I was growing up. I think that's what it was. I'd never heard that. And I think as a kid, I'd read, like, Spike Milligan's poems, you know, and I think later on maybe came across his war diaries and war memoirs, which are incredible. But the sort of inspired linking that he does between ideas is something that I hadn't seen. It's definitely something that you're not going to see in a show like Hello, Hello.
In a standard sitcom.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, before we move on possibly to the world of directing,
yes,
which is something you've come to in the last sort of decade or so.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just ask you, before we go there, do you have a, if you were asked, do you have a comedy hero? Who is it? And why?
Oh, gosh. I mean...
So, do you have...
I have a few of them. I think an enormous hero of mine is Victoria Wood. because I think what she achieved is extraordinary. Like, in terms of her output, which was, it was just her. That, you know, as a solo creator, it's remarkable what she did. I think Victoria Wood is seen on TV as one of the greatest comedy shows that's ever been on television. I think that she also, you know, the range of stuff that she could do, she wrote brilliant songs, brilliant comedy songs. She wrote astonishingly moving comedy dramas later on in her career. She never sort of sat still. And she did the thing that is so... It's so funny when people talk about her, because they sort of see her as this kind of cuddly figure almost, which is partly to do with her sort of physicality and the subjects. But she was vicious, and it, you know, that if you go and examine that comedy, it is vicious and it's brilliant. She sort of smuggled this kind of commentary, not for any social purpose, but she smuggled this commentary underneath this this kind of very welcoming carapace. And wow. I just think it's remarkable. I think Dinner Ladies is one of the great underrated masterpieces of the sitcom genre. And she herself felt like it had come out at the wrong time, because Dinner Ladies was contemporaneous with Caroline Ahern, Craig Cash's The Royal Family, and Henry Norman, of course. And The Royal Family changed everything in the way that sitcom worked, in terms of writing, in terms of directing, in terms of performing, what it was about, what it needed. It's such a little show, The Royal Family, in the best possible way. You know, there are big things, there are big themes here and there, but mostly, you know, particularly in those early shows, you're just watching half an hour of people nattering. That's really what it is. And Dinner Ladies was much more kind of bright, front-lit, multi-camera, everyone standing in a line to do their jokes kind of a show, which I know she'd have rather it be shot in another way. There is a world where it could have been done like we'd done The Thick of It, actually, and it would have been a brilliant show. But those characters are incredible. The lines are incredible. She makes this beautiful sort of heartbreaking story out of it, and she makes these enormous grand guignolish clowns. It's like, I suppose grand guignol is really, that's more like kind of blood and guts and so on. But I mean, I suppose what I'm trying to get at there is more like a huge caricaturish, mad, enormous. So like Julie Walters' character as her mother, absurd, but also utterly heartbreaking. She does this thing where she can turn on you. It's one of my favorite things in comedy, is when somebody is able to just pull the rug so brilliantly. The best example of it for me is the very end of the Fast show. Paul Whitehouse's wonderful Rolly Birkin QC. Rolly Birkin QC was a character that Paul Whitehouse used to do. Don't talk like that. And then he was sort of forgetting everyone what he's saying. And then everyone would talk like that, and words would come out. And then at the end, he would always, you know, you'd get little snatches of some story. Cairo, he'd start with, you know, and there would be some snatches of story. And then at the end, he'd say, I'm afraid I was very, very drunk, and which was the catchphrase of that catchphrase comedy. But the very final episode of that, he tells this story where he just becomes quite quiet and it becomes quite serious. And it's the same way of performing it, but on a very different plane of energy. And the words are, that we can gather, are sort of dark. A bit more dark. Yeah. And at the end, he says, she died in my arms. I'm afraid I was very, very drunk. And you can feel the audience go, what? They do not know what to do with it. And I just think it's such a phenomenally bold move just to pull that rug like that. But I think so. Victoria Wood. Is the one for me.
So she's your Well, let's move on then to the world of Sir Christopher Addison and the directing. How did you get into directing comedy? Well, what was your first experience of it?
It was directing an episode of The Thick of It. So what happened was that Armando and The Thick of It writers went to the States and did a sort of sister show for HBO called Veep, set in the offices of the vice president, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And they did their first season for HBO just before they had to do the last series of The Thick of It, following which they immediately had to go and do the second season for HBO. It was a ridiculous, ridiculous undertaking. Up to that point, Armando had directed all Thick of It, as you are well aware, Alex. But he realised at that point that he just didn't have the time. There just wasn't enough time for him to be able to do that and be on top of putting Veep 2 together. So for that final season, although he directed a couple of episodes, including the all-important Inquiry special, he got people from sort of within the family, as it were, to direct those episodes. And the reason that he did that was because even then it was still quite an unusual show in the way that it was put together. I remember talking to you about this actually years and years and years ago, after I had first done something that wasn't shot in the style of The Thick of It, because it had been my first experience of making a show in the way that a show is normally made, and I could not believe it. And you were laughing in my face, quite rightly, about my total naivety. Because The Thick of It, in conventional filming, what happens is, you rehearse a scene, you block the scenes, which is to say, all the actors know where and when they're going to be in the place, and then the cameras can figure out where they need to be for their various shots. The lights can be put in. People will put coloured marks on the floor for the actors to stand on so that they're in the right place for the cameras and the lights and so forth. None of that happened in The Thick of It. It was a very loosey-goosey style. So it was two handheld cameras, universal lighting. You could go where you wanted. It was really unusual. And the first time I ever went, the first thing I did after that was Skins. And I remember being on, and they went, "Can you stand there?" And I went, "Why?" And they went, "Well, that's where you're supposed to stand." "What do you mean? Could you move your head slightly so that the light can get past? What are you talking about?"
Yeah,
I could not believe it. It took me years to unpick. I've been brought up very badly as an actor and as a director because of The Thick of It, but and Veep, which was shot in the same way. But so because it was shot in this unusual way, and because of the improvisation aspect of it, and and also because it's a very intimidating looking show to put together, because the scripts are 60 pages long. Right, a half hour script should be 35 pages or so, but our scripts were 60 pages long as standard, and we shot them in 4 days as opposed to five. And so a director coming from the outside would go, "You're out of your goddamn mind, no way." But the way you shoot The Thick of it is achievable, right? So in order to bypass all of that nonsense, Arm brought in people from the family. So I did one. Natalie Bailey, Tony Roach, who is one of the writers, Billy Snedden himself, our editor, did what? So various people were sort of brought in. And Arm knew that I had wanted to be, before I got into stand-up, I'd wanted to be a theatre director. That was the thing that as a kid I was really interested in the idea of. So he said, come and do this. In that Armando-ish way of, you'd be interested in doing this, come over here and do this thing. So I directed... I think the fifth, maybe, episode in that season, the one before the Inquiry where it all blows up.
But you were in it as well.
And I was in it as well. Well, that was because I was making a film at the same time that I was in. The schedule worked out that I was supposed to do the first episode, which I wasn't in because none of the old government people were in the first episode. But it worked out that I had to do the fifth one, so I was in it. It was utterly bizarre, Tim. So it was so bizarre.
You had these moments where you go, "And you're fucking mad." Cut.
Yeah. We're just going. Yes, I absolutely did. Yeah.
Did that weird thing. I have no idea if you did it right or you're on point. But yeah, that'll do.
The most go and look at the most terrifying version of it was that on the fourth day, I was sitting eating my porridge. And looking over the pages of script for that day, and the production secretary came up to me and said, "Chris, sorry, Armando's ill, so he's not going to be here today," because he'd been sitting with us at the monitors,
right?
You know, and I was going, "What? Pardon?" But he said, "You know, you'll be fine."
Crackle.
So what? Pardon? And that day, I had to shoot as one of the last things. I had to shoot. There's a scene in that episode that is Ollie and Malcolm, so me and Peter. So it was me directing Peter directing, and the impertinence of trying to direct Peter Capel. Can you imagine? Or Rebecca Front saying to those people, "Could you do this?" is mind blowing.
But also, presumably, where your personality in that scene is subservient.
Yep. So you're also,
in role, 100%. Having to be the bitch.
Yes.
As it were, being completely
absolutely
shat on. And
yeah,
going,
yeah, yeah.
No, you need to be stronger, Peter.
It was utterly mad, the whole thing. And I used to find with Ollie that, because he's such a beta character in any case, and they would dress me in these unbelievably cheap suits, and I could feel like I could feel the weakness, I could feel all strength going out of me as I would put these kind of, they were so awful. These suits. I remember, you know how they used to drive us down to set. And I would get out of the car, and every time I got out of the car, I get a massive static shock because of the cheapness of these suits. So I was in this cheap staticky suit, with this ridiculous hair, trying to and not really being able to see what we were recording either, because we didn't have any monitors. It was a shoestring production. And there was no Armando to go, yep, that was fine. It was ridiculous.
Did you have some technique for being able to be in the scene?
No.
No, Alex. And act.
No.
But also observe, he's not done that quite correctly, and she's not done that quite correctly. I must make a note of that for when I give notes. Did you have a technique?
No, because I was making it up as I went along in all regards at that point. I was just trying to get through any given moment. I mean, I don't think I was very present as an actor, shall we say? So I was probably thinking more about that other stuff because that was terrifying me. And by that point, I was quite used to how it worked when I was being bollocked by Malcolm. That was part of my bread and butter by that point. But I remember reading. I watched Bradley Cooper's astonishing biopic of Leonard Bernstein, Maestro.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Now, and he plays Bernstein in that, and he directs the thing. And I'm reading an interview with him. There's this incredible scene between him and his daughter where he's sort of lying to his daughter about, about his fidelity. And it's quite a powerful scene. And and he apparently hooked, whilst he was doing it, hooked the camera with his foot to pull it in a little bit further. Whilst he's doing it, I was thinking, I don't know how you even begin to do that. That was my first experience.
Into direct.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just going to pick up on, very briefly, the heavy lifting that the first AD and the DOP do. Did you find that they were, so just for the viewer and listener, the DOP is the director of photography, and the first AD is the sort of sergeant major of the set who kind of runs it on an operational basis.
Yes.
When you were doing the shoot, days themselves, did you not find that you had plenty of headspace and time because they were picking up the load or not?
I think you'll never have plenty of headspace and time. There's so much stuff that's going on. A good first assistant director has quite an artistic sensibility, and they know what you're after. So they're doing two things. They are being the sergeant major, and they are pointing at their watch and going at you and making you move on. But they're also, they're aware that you can't leave without getting the thing. There is so much pressure when you are on set to do everything as quickly as you possibly can. And you constantly have to remind yourself and people around you that the whole reason we spent all of these months and all of this money is to get to this point. And if we leave this point without the thing that we came for, the whole thing is bust.
Yeah.
But the panic that can set in can make you leave without first capturing what you came to capture. A good first AD knows we can't move on because we haven't got the thing. Director of photography is a really interesting one because I think the director of photography that you need for any given project will change depending on what the project is, because they're artists, right? They are extraordinary craftspeople, but they're also artists. And the best directors of photography for my purposes are ones who understand comedy and can find the shots that will best represent the comedy, or find something, an extra thing, just by the way that they've framed it or the way that what they're pointing at in any particular moment that will then elevate the scene that you've got, because you've got your script that's funny, you've got the way that the performers are doing it that's funny, but actually where you place your camera and how you film those lines and those performances absolutely changes how funny the thing is.
Is there truth in this concept of drama is shot in single shots and comedy is shot in two shots? Now, is that rhubarb?
No. So there are. No, I don't think it's entirely rhubarb. I think there are a number of things that you hear that are sort of slightly gnomic statements like that, that say things like comedy is in the wide shot, but they will also say comedy is in the close up. No, it can't be both of those things, can it? Okay. And the answer is it depends on what it is that you're conveying in that moment. Actually, Alex, I think there's a lot to be said for the idea that comedy is in the two shot. But I would also argue that that's the case with drama. I think for me, the longer I go through my career as a director, the more interested I become in shots that contain more than one character, because actually the real magic between actors is when you can see them reacting to one another, when you feel something organic happening. The minute that you separate them out into single shots, you're mosaicing together something in an edit. Now, often enough, you have to do that for various reasons, for time, for timing, in order to be able to to choose your performances as you want to. Absolutely, the most magical shots, I think, and the most magical performances are almost always when you have people together. And I think that's true in drama as it is in comedy. Really, what it comes down to is elegance.
If we can take the directing, because we've directed quite a few things in advertising settings, and I've tried to do funny a bit, but I kind of equated it a bit to conducting an orchestra.
Yeah,
and you could to one degree, you're thinking it's down to me to make sure every part of every section performs at exactly the right moment,
yes.
And I need to make sure they're drilled, they're prepped, they know, and they're all focusing on my drill.
Yeah,
but on the other side, I should just wiggle about a bit and they should just do it. And I need to empower them to feel they're brilliant and they can just get on with it. And with comedy, it's so difficult because you're trying to get... I wondered, as directing comedy, what in your own tool bag you do to try and create an atmosphere where it is funny.
Well, there are lots of parts to that question. I think your job as the director, first of all, is not... I think your job is to be the keeper of the vision, right? Your job isn't to know exactly how every single bit of this should run. Your job is to get the best people that you possibly can, give them license to do their best possible work, and corral it in such a way that it stays within the remit of what you want to happen or what the whole thing needs to be, okay? But you don't have to tell everybody precisely what they're supposed to do all the time. You do need to adjust what's happening so that it all fits into the same space, and you need to give them room in which to do their best work. So that goes to the question of how you create an atmosphere. Now, a lot of directors, the thing that I despise is when I hear people say of directors, and there are many very famous directors you'll hear this about, oh, he's a genius. He's a genius. Very difficult to work with, very difficult to work for, but a genius. Well, he's not a genius then, is he? He's not a genius if he's creating a situation in which people are fearful for their jobs, not enjoying their working environment and so on. Your job, you're not the host of a party, but your job is to make people feel like they are appreciated, that they can do their work, that their decisions are valued and valid, their ideas are valued and valid, and you will make decisions not based on whether you think they themselves are shit or not, but whether the particular ideas that they're bringing to you fit with the whole thing that you're trying to do. I personally try and make it so that I'm terrible at names, but I really try and learn everybody's name on set with the crew. I really try and make it feel like we are a gang who are doing this thing together. I think it's very important that be the atmosphere on set.
Sorry to stop you. Yeah. I think you've come up with the answer there. We're saying you're hosting a party. I think that's actually a really useful moniker, really. You say it's not, but actually that is the ideal director. I'm going to host a party where everyone's having a really good time.
But also it can't spread, right? So because you are on the clock and you do have specific things to get.
Yeah.
So actually, like, what you can't do is license anybody to do whatever they want the whole time. It's finding a space where people feel empowered, but you're also disciplined enough to get the things that you need to get.
It's three cocktail sausages, one slice of cake.
Yeah, And you're out.
Don't help yourself to the buffet.
Precisely. Yeah. But they are lovely cocktail sausages. You're going to really dig.
Three, and that's your lot.
But
you enjoy.
Yeah. But also, and so much of that comes from before you get to set. Right. So, like, this decisions you make before you get to set are far more vital than the ones that you make on set in regard to that. The first and the most important one, and this is one of the things that I learned from Armando Iannucci, is the golden rule is no arseholes on set. The way that I would really like to make my money, and there are big legal obstacles to this, but I would like to put together an app for the industry called Right Nuisance, in which you could look up whether certain heads of department or actors are right nuisances or not, and avoid them as a consequence.
IMDb should introduce that.
Completely. They should.
Star system needs a little red button beside it.
Is this person a right nuisance or not? Because that's
very politely, that's a right nuisance.
Yeah, right. That is the right.
Not. It could be something else, but we're going to call that's them what a right nuisance.
But fundamentally, that's what they are.
They're a nuisance to the process.
They are a nuisance to the process. And I understand, by the way, it's not straightforward. I do understand why certain people act in that way. I think for actors, there is a huge amount of pressure once they're in front of the camera because suddenly everybody is literally looking at them and it comes down to this specific moment. So I do understand where the pressure comes from. However, I have met people who respond to that pressure better and worse, right? So so I think that the decisions of who you cast, which are not always down to you in these days of, we must cast the names that people are interested in. Decisions on who you cast, who you hire for your heads of department in particular, which is to say, the production designer, the costume designer, the makeup, the electrician, all those.
I think vital. First AD is your most crucial appointment.
So important.
Because they set the tone for every other department.
Completely.
In terms of the stress level or whether it's a pleasure.
Completely. Yeah. And I think that the it all trickles down. So it's the director, number one on the call sheet, which is to say the star, the first assistant director and the producer are the people who really set the tone, particularly the first AD, the star and the director. And what happens if those people behave badly, it licenses other people to behave badly.
Right.
And so it becomes a bit, it can become a bit poisonous. But if you have excellent number ones, and you have a director who is interested in making people empowered rather than feared, then you've a good chance of setting an atmosphere where the good stuff can happen. And the other answer is be prepped. Like, really be prepared. Not everybody is, and I wasn't always. And it's like I said to you earlier, I've been brought up so badly as a director and as an actor through the thick of it in Veep because they are very kick bollock scramble. They're very semi improvisatory, and the way that they're shot means that you don't do some of the preparation that you might otherwise do for something like putting together shot lists and plans for the day and so forth.
I was just going to say, what is prep for a director on the day? Can you just briefly give us
the biggest lesson that I've learned over the sort of decade of doing this is in the last thing that I made, which is a show called Breeders, my director of photography for most of that, a fabulous guy called Stephen Ferguson, and Stephen and I would meet. We would spend weeks going through scripts, figuring out, and also through the schedule. So the scripts and the schedule are two sorts of different things. The script obviously is the story in order. The schedule is the order that you're going to shoot things in. And on the schedule, it'll say these are the script pages that we will shoot. These are the scenes we will shoot on this particular day. So there'll be five or six scenes, say, and we know in our heads, right? Well, we've got 13 hours, or whatever it is. We've got 11 hours, more like. We've got 11 hours. We've got that gives us time to do this many camera setups because it takes this long to light things. It takes this long to shoot things on average. So let's break those scenes down and figure out how we can do all of that work in the number of setups and shots that we need to, whilst getting all of the things that we need. What in those scenes do we need in terms of coverage of our actors? What do we need in terms of special shots? What do we think is going to be funny in terms of our framing?
Now, how do you work that bit out? Because otherwise you're just capturing spaces, doing some stuff.
Yeah, and interestingly, Tim, I think that's been a big problem with comedy In the sort of, particularly in the noughties going into the 2010s, that there was a particular kind of comedy led really by a lot of the film comedies of the American film comedies of the time, where they were interested in improvisation as an idea and to the cost of everything else, pretty much.
Right,
so
right.
So there weren't many people making comedies that look like they've been considered, right? So Edgar Wright is a great example of someone who, if you look at an Edgar Wright movie, if you know, from Shaun of the Dead on, and even like A Fistful of Fingers that he did, you know, years ago as a, effectively as a kid, there's so every frame in that is put together in such a way as to be funny, supportive of the emotional moment that it's capturing, and so on. Whereas if you look at a lot of mainstream studio comedies of a few years later, you're looking at things where they're basically doing a master shot of everybody and they're cross-covering, which means they're shooting at the same time in two different directions, two actors in a kind of mid-ish or close-ish shot, so that those guys can riff and improvise, and they'll capture all of that, and that's what they're interested in. They don't really care about the visuals. And that is a legitimate way of doing it, but I think we lost something when that happened. And it was interesting. I think it started to change a bit when Bridesmaids was shot, because I think Paul Feig, who directed Bridesmaids, has a very different idea of how you go about doing those things. He is interested in the improvisation, because he's got Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy, and you know, even his kind of bit players are Jess St. Clair and people like that, who are really great at that stuff. So he's got all of those people, and he knows what a value that is. But he's also super aware of what shot is funny and why it's funny and why this is the best version of that. A great example is there's a famous moment in Bridesmaids where they're all in the bridalware shop and they all get food poisoning, and Maya Rudolph is suddenly in this big meringue dress and she desperately needs a shit. Mm. And she runs across the road to try it, because there's nowhere to go in the shop. She runs across the road and she doesn't make it before her bowels give way. And the shot that Paul Feig chooses is really telling. He doesn't go on her face. He stays out wide and we watch her sink down. It's such a phenomenal
like a
shot. Like a swan. It's absolutely beautiful. But it's a very specifically chosen shot, and he's very interesting with that stuff.
That's a perfect example of how a shot can make something funny.
Yeah,
you're right. It could easily be that he was in on her face with the reaction of what she's
no.
It's funny from that long.
And
is because the comedy is in the dress, the fact that she's in that. If it's just a oh shit moment,
it's quite. I don't know where the comedy is technically speaking, but I just know that is the right shot.
It is.
Yeah, it's
it
instinct
is.
More than a reason.
I think that's the thing. Is ultimately all of this stuff comes down to instinct, but there are certain things that you know that you like or that you find funny, right? That visually, I like it when I see people do that. One of the reasons that We Are Lady Parts is such a fantastic show is that the direction it's so detailed, it's so spot on. Every single shot in that show is thought about in terms of how it tells the emotional story of those characters, or how it makes the moment that's funny as it possibly could be, without ever spilling out into being pleased with itself.
Right.
You know, it never feels arch. It never feels like it is overdone. All of those choices are very specific. The Nina Menzel's made, and they're absolutely superb.
Just for the purposes of elegance,
yeah,
we've done pre-production,
yeah,
we've done the shoot day.
Yeah.
Can you give us a short vignette on what the post-production is like as a director, and where the funny might enter into that equation?
So, the thing that is most underrated in the entire film and TV making process by even people inside it, let alone people outside it, is the post-production aspect of it, which is because when we think of filmmaking, what we see in our heads is a camera on a crane, a director with a baseball cap and a puffer jacket pointing at something, right? that's the image in our heads. That's filmmaking, is all of that stuff. That is resource gathering. Actual making of those shows takes place in a small, shitty room in Soho amongst a lot of sandwich wrappers, and very cheap computer equipment in one of the cheapest parts of the process, the offline edit. And that is where the editor and the director sit together and figure out how to take each of those shots and bolt them together to maximum effect. And I thought when I started that it would be the most boring part of the process because it would be watching over and over and over again the same thing. In truth, it's the most fascinating part of the process, and it's the most powerful part of the process in terms of how you make it funny or don't make it funny. The choice of shot that you use for a given line or a given moment, the timing that you can give on that, the timing that you can change in a cut, the fact that you can put a reaction in somewhere to sort of lead the audience is remarkable. When we were shooting Veep, we would often do a version where we weren't paying attention to the people who were speaking, but we would just sort of range around the other characters in the scene. And what you get from that is you get just little moments that you can kind of, you can just sort of slip in that absolutely elevate it. Very often it would be a shot of Matt Walsh, who played Mike, looking utterly bamboozled by something that his boss had just said. There's Anthony Boyes, one of the great editors on that show, and I once, just out of fun, cut an entire scene where the gang in Veep, Selena Meyer, the vice president herself, and her apparatchiks, are standing in her office discussing in a panicked fashion some word cloud report of something that's happened the day before. And we just basically cut it round Matt Walsh reacting to everybody else and being totally at sea. And we didn't use it in the end, but it would be a completely legitimate way to do it because it was so funny.
Yeah, I think there should almost be a rule that whoever is talking on camera should never be on the screen.
Right.
And it's all about the reaction, because that's the most interesting part.
Completely.
People are reacting to this almighty great row.
Absolutely.
Rather than the row itself.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Because sometimes a light like... It, you do see it sometimes in edits where people have gone... You see them show you the line, then show you the reaction, then show you the next line, and you go, "Oh, but the timing's all out now." Okay. Like it's
the line, then the reaction. No. The reaction occurred two seconds ago.
Yeah. That's correct. That's it.
Absolutely.
And you can feel it. You know, even if you don't consciously understand what's happening, we're humans who communicate all the time using language, and we know exactly how the rhythms of that work. It's deep in our bones, and you can feel when that stuff is off.
Throughout your experience.
Yeah.
Can you distill down to one sort of nice formula in DNA terms what makes something funny? What makes Breeders funny? What makes Veep funny? What makes The Thick of It funny? Because we asked Billy this and we've asked others this, and we forced them to come down to a short little formula. Do you think have you got one in your mind?
I think it's something surprising done rhythmically. So comedy is music, right? And all of it is about rhythm and approach and note and speed and all of the things that you would associate with music, right? All of the things that are written on a musical score. Do this slowly. Do this with a tack. You know, this is pizzicato. This bit is pizzicato. This bit is fortissimo. This bit is pianissimo. All of that stuff absolutely relates to comedy.
With that in mind, the director or conductor of the orchestra, how do you create that vision to know this is an allegro moment, this is an adagio, this is a picazzo?
We can unpick comedy as much as we want to, right? And I love doing that. But to construct it from the ground up is almost impossible.
Yeah.
There are courses designed to teach people to be stand-ups and whatever. And you can learn certain techniques of those, but you can't learn how to be funny. That is a known or unknown thing to you. It is fascinating to me that there are people in the world who are hilarious, but if you put them in a performing environment, they can't translate that somehow, right? There are people who simply don't get any of it. There are some people who bleed funny. It doesn't matter what they say or how they are. People like Lee Mack, right? Lee Mack is the funniest person on God's earth, because it's just in him. It's just how he operates as a linguistic being, right? And some people get it, some people don't get it. There's no synthesizing it.
I think it's a perfect answer to the question, which is you can't calculate it.
No.
You want to, you think there must be a formula.
There isn't.
Absolutely correct. You cannot calculate it, and that's what the answer is.
Which is fantastic news, given though we're all desperately concerned that computers will try and take over the writing and crafting of all sorts of magic in the future. But I think it's going to be very difficult for it to work out the algorithm.
But mentally. I think, you know, so there's a lot of comedy, or there's a lot of what is labelled comedy that you see that you go, oh, I can see how this has been put together. That is sort of formulaic. I would imagine that artificial intelligence could absolutely manage to do something like that. But it's the key is, who can do the surprising bit? Like, you can. What's the word I'm looking for? You can kind of mosaic together, I suppose. You can try and, you know, in a Frankenstein together, ideas and rhythms and subjects and types of characters and types of situations and so on, to make a perfectly serviceable, okay comedy script. And the world is full of okay comedy scripts. The truth is, comedy is like every other art form. Like, there's a bottom bit of it that is absolute shit. There's a top bit of it that is just glorious. And there's a huge amount of it that is fine. And that is the same with every art form. It's the same with music, it's the same with painting, it's the same with everything.
You go around a gallery, I'll find the sunflowers and a Caravaggio, and the rest of it's okay.
Fine, yeah, yeah.
And then there's some dross.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah.
I strongly suspect that AI will absolutely be able to do stuff that is okay. And but the difference is, will it be, because it's the stuff that blows the wall out at one side of your brain. Like, will it be able to do that? Will it be able to replicate the first time that I heard The Goons, or the first time I saw Billy Connolly? Will it be able to, could AI come up with James Acaster? Because there wasn't a James Acaster before James Acaster came along, you know?
Yeah. Very briefly, what, Christopher, have you stolen from another comedy director that you use in your own day-to-day practice?
One of the funniest things that is guaranteed to make me laugh every time I see it, and I appreciate that this is an audio medium, so you're going to have to bear with me here. Imagine a door frame, an empty door frame. Nobody is in that door frame, right? But you stand a performer just out of frame, so they can't be seen, but they can lean in, and this is the key. They don't lean forwards in any way. They don't lean backwards. They lean entirely from the side, right, into the frame. I find it unaccountably funny. Right, I remember going to see Noises Off, the greatest play ever written. I remember going to see Noises Off about 25 years ago, something like that, at the Piccadilly Theatre in London. Chris Langham was playing Freddie, and he did it. He leant into the doorframe like that, and I lost my shit. And he does it again in one of the first three, I think, episodes of The Thick of It. He sort of leans in when Malcolm's in a room, and it is unbelievably funny. I find whenever an actor does that, I find it funny. I shot a pilot last year with Jimmy Nesbitt, and I got him to stand and do exactly that by a wall. He leaned in. I had to be very specific with him about the physicality of it. No forward movement. It's all got to be lateral. It is extraordinarily funny.
So that's what you've stolen from you. Great. Timbo, anything else you want to ask? Because I don't want to prevent you from...
This is more of a funny, silly thing, but is there a clip or a moment or a joke or a sketch or something that you've seen that you think is the funniest thing that you...
Two things immediately come to mind. One is it's such a cliche now, because there have been so many kind of talking heads TV shows about this... kind of moment, and this always comes up, but the way that it's shot and whenever the talking head shows do it, they ruin it by breaking the clip up with the talking head, right? But if you watch the Fawlty Towers episode where Basil has to go and get the dinner from the other hotel, from Andre, because the kitchens are all to fuck and he's hosting gourmet night, right? His car breaks down, and famously he Cleese gets out and he goes, "I'm warning you." He threatens the car. I've told you time and time and time again. Now, the way it's shot is the car is sort of, obviously it's in that old 4:3 ratio, so it's a sort of squarish thing. The car is basically inside a frame as far as it can be. Cleese is in profile more or less in this fabulous angular way, threatening this car. And then he runs out of frame and there's a pause, and he runs back in with a branch and starts whipping the car with the branch. It is astonishing. It's a really good example. It's a great bit of directing in that it's just left. It's just a locked off frame and you just see the thing. And I remember watching that for the first time and absolutely losing my mind. And the other one that I can really remember taking me completely by surprise I had to sort of pause. Oh, I've got another one. I had to sort of pause. There's an episode of Father Ted where they think Father Jack has died. And they sort of lay him out. And Ted comes towards camera and does this sort of long kind of elegy about Jack and what he was like. In the middle of which, Jack wakes up and says something to the effect of, well, that fucking gobshite never, you know, shut up or whatever. And it's such a, and Ted then falls backwards in a brilliant fall. So he doesn't bend. He just goes straight back. And it is magnificent. And both of those things are very similar, actually, in that they are pieces of they're pieces of timing and a specific kind of physical comedy where you're distracted for a moment and then surprised. Both of those I've had to sort of recover myself after.
What's your third one?
I think the greatest entry of any comedy character ever is in the pilot episode of 30 Rock when Jack Donaghy, as played by Alec Baldwin, first turns up, and Tina Fey, Liz and Pete go up to meet Gary, their boss, and they get to Gary's office, but Gary's office is now a building site and there's plastic up everywhere and there's boards and stuff, and Liz goes, "Where's Gary?" And Jack Donaghy kicks one of the boards out. He goes flying out and he walks through and goes, "Gary's dead." And in description, it sounds like nothing. In the timing and the shooting and the sheer, what the fuck is this-ness of it, I remember having to pause the video and recover myself for 3 or 4 minutes.
Oh, great. Well, I think we've totally squeezed the pips. Let's just say a colossal thank you to Gladys.
Thanks for having me.
So great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, fellas.